Welcome, dear listeners, to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. As always, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Arvind. Last week, we completed the Bhagavatam fortnight, where we speak about the Bhagavat Vaini. And there we spoke about an interesting situation where a person is facing impending death and how he spends the time that he has to spend by the time the death comes. You know, we know the story of Parikshit. 7 days is all that he's left with. And he asked this question, how these 7 days have to be spent. And it's all about the death causing the situation, the curse that he has, and how he plans his life for those 7 days. And what we're going to be talking today is probably quite different and quite right contrary to what we spoke about in the last 2 weeks. But we know that in Swami's scheme of things, nothing is out of place. We will, as we go through this, I think we will learn something which will complement what we learned in that Bhagavat Vaini satsang, where we spoke about how one's life has to be led. But the way we're going to approach it, it's going to be completely different. But before we go into that, we most lovingly offer our loving pranams at Swami's lotus feet. And let's ask Arvind to join all of us. Sairam Arvind.
Sairam Prem. That was a nice introduction, because this is precisely what was going on in my mind too, thinking how different it is what we are speaking this week, what we are discussing this week, compared to what we discussed the previous week, the previous fortnight in fact. But on the other hand, the other thought that comes is, are they actually different? Because
right,
the basis, the foundation is verily the same. One of the most popular or most common prayers that we do as students or as devotees, and in fact this prayer is a very popular one across organizations, across masters. It's not just a prayer that is commonly used in the Satya Sai organization or in the Satya Sai centers. And that prayer goes as Asatoma Satgamaya, Tamasoma Jyotirgamaya, Mrityorma Amritangamaya. It's a prayer seeking the supreme power to lead me from untruth to truth, lead me from darkness to light, and lead me from death to immortality.
And just to add how universal the prayer is, I think it was even used in a movie like Matrix. That was the background when the credits start rolling.
Correct. At the end of the movie.
Really, that's how universal and how relatable the message is. It's not anything got to do with Sanatan Dharma or anything religious or ritualistic, but completely spiritual and so applicable to any spiritual aspirant wherever he or she belongs to.
When we are taking up a theme as we have given today, that is resurrection is a rebirth, definitely we will be going into many wonderful, mind-boggling, mind-numbing, in fact, instances where Swami has revived people from the dead. It's not just one-off case or two-off cases. There are dozens, and we will be picking the more famous, more popular ones, because they are well-documented, the more well-documented ones. And of course, we will also be going into a few not-so-well-documented ones, but which are phenomenal and definitely devotion-arousing. But before we go into those stories, it becomes so important that we understand the import of this prayer, especially the third line, which says, Mrityorma Amritam Gamaya, which is, lead me from death to immortality. It does not say, lead me from death to life. And I feel that is a very important thing we have to keep in mind throughout this satsang, as well as possibly next week if it spills over, that the prayer of a devotee is Mrityorma Amritangamaya, and that is also the Lord's desire. The Lord's desire is also to take us from Mrityu to Amritam, from death to immortality. And therefore, in that context, we have to look at all these resurrections, because a question that might arise is, why only a few are resurrected, why others are not resurrected? If the goal of the Lord is to lead us away from death, then everybody, at least half of the devotees, should get resurrected. That is why we should focus on this prayer, that the goal is to lead us away from death, not to life. It is the goal and the prayer and God's desire is to lead us from death to immortality. And if leading us towards immortality means resurrecting us physically, God will do that. If leading us to immortality means allowing us to suffer, God will do that. So I think this will be the basic premise. This will be the underlying foundation on which we will build the superstructure of resurrection being a rebirth.
I think that's a very beautiful point that you made, because, you know, if you look at some of these scriptures, the different Puranas, you'll always have this episode of an asura who is doing a lot of penance, you know, a demon who is doing penance, intense penance, and Lord Brahma or Lord Shiva appears before him, and they're so benevolent, they say that we are ready to give you anything that you ask for, but don't ask for immortality. I mean, that is the caveat they put forth first. You know, you ask for anything, but, and that's why you have all of these very, very innovative ways of asking for boons. We have seen Hiranyakashipu, Hiranyaksha, and the very many asuras, very interesting how they ask, how they believe they can become immortal. In fact, Ravana is one who says, who lists, he gives up a big list and says, I should not be killed by any of these, and he leaves out human beings because he feels that he's going to never have a threat from them. Or Hiranyakashipu, we have that. In, not in the sky, not in the earth.
He gives all, desha kala parisiti, the time, right, the people, the circumstance, everything he tries to cover up.
Right. And the message which comes across is always that there cannot be amritam, or there cannot be immortality. But still this prayer is, lead me from death to immortality. And I think the important thing, as you very beautifully said, is the end of the day, life has to be led. So your life is going to be led, defined by what? Is it going to be defined by the death of the body or immortality of the spirit? And that is what will give the flavor of your entire life. And it is not about going beyond death. In fact, there's one very beautiful point, observation that Swami makes, which all of us do. You know, Swami says that when you fall sick, you take some medicines, or let's say that you get a life-threatening disease, you try your best to sort it out and try to extend your life. So Swami is saying that, you know, your true nature is the spirit, the Atman, which we all know Swami has said so many times. And the nature of the Atman is immortality. It does not die. But Swami went on to say that because you associate your body with yourself, you think that I am this body, you all the time keep craving for immortality for the body. So the whole thing is just a shift of focus, then you realize that you already are immortal and you're not just associating yourself with that immortality.
And that is precisely the mistakes our asuras do, because they think that when God is refusing them immortality, they think that God is refusing immortality. Oh, what they don't realize is God is refusing them the immortality in the way they are thinking. As you rightly said, immortality is not about the body made up of the five elements lasting forever. In fact, some time ago I was watching a National Geographic or a BBC documentary, I don't remember, about life and death. And in that, they were explaining how science looks at death and how science looks at evolution of species itself. The documentary stated that the goal of life is to live. And therefore, life keeps looking at ways in which it can
survive.
That is exactly mrityorma amritangamaya. Life does not want to die. And so, on one hand, there is this process of evolution that makes you stronger, smarter, and all these things which help you to increase your lifespan. It increases longevity. That's why you'll see the lower the animal or creature is on the evolutionary scale, most probably lifespan is lesser. In fact, on an average, if you see, it's the humans who live the longest. Yeah, of course, you may say there's a turtle that lives 120 years, or there's an elephant that lives 100 years. Yeah, those are exceptions, not only as individual beings, but possibly even among species, maybe the tortoise is an exception or something like that. But generally, the more evolved the species, the longer the lifespan. And humans have the longest lifespan that way. So that is one way life tries to, you know, reach amritam. The other way is, apparently, life, whatever it is, you know, we call it God, we call it consciousness. So life also recognizes that the body is going to disintegrate. And they say that that is the reason why sexual reproduction developed. Because the earliest, if you see the primitive creatures, they just reproduced asexually. And They just were growing. Even asexual reproduction, the concept of reproduction itself is one way of ensuring that, you know, things live on.
Right.
If you bring together asexual reproduction, which is just nothing but cloning the same being over and over again.
What happens in most of the plants? Grafting, what do you call it?
Grafting or even primitive creatures.
Cell divisions, right.
If you bring together asexual reproduction along with evolution, that is what results in sexual reproduction. Because in sexual reproduction, what happens is there is a mixing of the virtues from two parents. All the good is brought together and there's an attempt made to ensure that the good progresses and the negatives reduce. That is the reason why, you know, even in common day parlance, you will say that, you know, kids of this generation are very smart. And this has been a constant statement across last five generations. Every time they say that kids of this generation is smart, that is not something extraordinary. It is built in to the process of evolution. And so, you know, evolution and asexual reproduction coming together is sexual reproduction. So you see, that documentary was explaining that life in itself tries to head towards immortality, and even life recognizes that immortality is not just by trying to ensure longevity to the physical frame. Of course, one aspect of it is trying to elongate the longevity, but that's not the sum and whole of immortality, because immortality involves evolution. And as Swami says, where science ends, spirituality begins. Science ends with that, possibly, and thinking evolution is the evolution of the mind. But spirituality takes it further ahead, saying evolution doesn't stop with the evolution of the mind, because evolution of the mind stops possibly at a perfect human being. But Swami says, you're not animal, you're human. You're not human, you're God. So the next part of evolution becomes complete only with spirituality. And it is only when the spiritual component is introduced that I feel life will truly attain Mrityorma Amritangamaya.
Absolutely. I think all that it suggests is, life itself is an opportunity to head towards that direction. You know, that is what Swami would often say. I mean, what Swami would refer to, the Vedanta philosophy, which always speaks about, moment you consider the body as a dress that the soul wears, I mean, how absurd it would be that every day when I'm taking off these white clothes and wearing my night clothes, I start crying. You know, I say, oh my God, I'm dying now. It's, you know, that is what Krishna tells in the Gita, that you have to understand that this is nothing but a garment that you're wearing. You're going to shed it when it becomes dirty and take another one, a fresh one for the next day. It's almost like that. The whole idea is, when you are living, to direct this idea towards the feeling that I am not the body, I am the Atman. And when that happens, automatically you actually gravitate towards the idea of immortality. But the moment you say that I want to become immortal, I want to live more, it is like asserting more and more the idea that I am the body. When you're referring to the body and saying, I want to be healthy, I don't want to have pain, I want to live for longer, I want to live for 100 years. And the thing is, as we're going to go through this, the various episodes that we have, the question which will come is, why for that person, why not for others? Because, I mean, we are a population of 7 billion in the world, which means, I don't know what is the rate at which people die. You know, I think every second there might be a few 100,000 people dying. So why this act of grace is not for everybody is a question which will come and which will never be completely and comprehensively answered, at least not by us sitting here. But one hint which is available is it going to lead to this process? Is it going to aid in some way in helping this process of living a little more life in the body, which will head towards the idea that one is not the body?
Absolutely. In fact, when you were mentioning the example of the cloth, I was reminded of a very nice question and answer that Swami himself gave in a discourse. I don't remember the exact date of the discourse, but, you know, Swami says that every time you change clothes, you don't cry, because you know that the clothes are meant to be that. They are meant to be worn and discarded. So too, Swami would say, that's what it is. The objective of life is to realize that you are the wearer of the clothes and not the cloth itself. So Swami then goes on to say that every time you are born, you are getting a new cloth. And every time you die, the cloth is getting torn. So that cloth has to be discarded and you have to buy a new cloth. So everything makes sense. And, you know, as you beautifully said, that is what the objective of life is about. To move away from Dehabhimanam towards Atmabhimanam. Dehabhimanam is attachment to the cloth. Then Swami himself posed the question in the discourse and he says, but sometimes some children some people die at a young age. It's not that everybody reaches a ripe old age and dies. Then Swami says, how do you explain that? Why is it that some people die young, some people die old? Then Swami says, see, for example, you bought a new safari cloth and he even gives some brand and this. And he says, imagine you went and kept it in the cupboard.
Right.
And you kept it in the cupboard and you locked it, Almira. After 20 years, you discovered that cloth. Then you got a shirt stitched from that. But the moment you wore it after it came from the tailor and you pulled it, it tore. And you'll wonder, how come a new cloth tore? It is new in the sense that it was stitched recently, but it's actually 20 year old. You know, Swami said, so also, you don't realize that what you're thinking as a newborn baby or a new life is not as new as you're thinking. Every life has a history which spans across lifetimes, across generations. And you know, that's how beautifully Swami explained the concept of karma and how sometimes what we think as new is not new and what we think as young is not actually young. It is the eternal ancient self. So I was just, this example was just triggered when we were discussing that.
I think very beautiful. I've heard that discussed very sweetly. Swami explains that. I think only Swami can think of it that way. But even as we go through these experiences, I think another thing which we have to keep in mind is another episode which we spoke about in the Ramayana. You know, before Sugriva forges that friendship with Rama, you know, he wants to give this task of handling Vali to him. What does he do? He first wants to know, is Rama capable of doing this? Is Rama capable of doing what he wants him to do in with regard to Vali? And it is only after that he says, I accept you. And of course, we know that full sequence of events which happens. He becomes emotionally devoted to Rama. So that is the first step, they say, you know, when you talk about the Bhakti Marga, when you turn to God, the first thing is, Swami would also say that, test me, but after you test me, accept me and don't test me after that. So it is important as devotees for us to look at Swami and first understand that he is capable of these things. I think that is a very important thing. You know, when we are facing problems, we should never think that Swami is not doing anything because it is beyond his capacity or beyond his ability. For us to know that there's absolutely nothing beyond his ability, I think when an avatar comes down, he does these things. And in fact, if you read some of the lives of some saints, which India has been blessed to have plenty, you would find so many stories of resurrection happening in their lives through them. So it is not that it doesn't happen in the absence of a physical avatar, but when an avatar comes, it is an opportunity for, I think, common folk like us to see that God always has the ability to change anything. And there is nothing which is beyond his ability. And then when we are in a situation, keep that as one of the factors. Swami can, but he still doesn't. So what does that mean? And to our situation, we have to derive at the answer for ourselves.
In his own way, Swami also keeps reminding us, you know, of his abilities. I remember reading the experience of a former Anandpur sister who studied in the Anandpur College. She was saying on one occasion how, you know, Swami was telling them that they are supposed to do something. And I'm not remembering the specifics, but they were not doing it. So Swami came and said, All of you have done what I have said? And they were saying, yes, Swami, we did it. That is what they were saying. Because you can't tell Swami, I didn't do. Then Swami said, okay, all those who have done, it's fine. Those who have not done, they will be failing in the next exam. You know? And immediately out came the culprits and, you know, something like, I don't remember the specifics. But the thing is, deep within we know that if Swami wills, however well I study, it's not going to matter. So, as you said, all this again, this is also the Sai Bhagavatam, and therefore faith is a very, very important aspect as we go through all these stories.
When you were saying about that, I remembered another incident where there were these set of boys who wanted to work in Swami's institutions and Swami was telling them to go away, I think way back in the 80s. So Swami was coming to each boy and asking what is the plan and all that. So there was this one boy who had completed his BSc, and those days there was no MSc in a university. So they had to go to Anantapur or Bangalore and study. So this boy told Swami that, Swami, I finished my BSc, I would like to work here, but if Swami wants me to go back, I'll prefer to pursue higher studies. So he told Swami in Telugu, he said, Swami, if it is possible for Swami, if Swami can give me a seat in Anantapur in SK University, then I'll be happy to study there. And Swami was like, suddenly Swami's face changed and he said, what did you say? He said, if Swami can. If that much faith you have in Swami, then Swami will definitely not do for you. Swami said, how can you ask if Swami can? Certainly Swami can. There is nothing which is beyond Swami's ability. I think that even that prayer needs to be backed with that faith. Sometimes it might not be in words, but we know that Swami can, and that's why we turn to Swami. So I think even when someone is on a deathbed, even when someone is facing the last few moments of their life or last few days of their life, I think that option that if Swami wants, Swami can stop this is never out of the thing. I mean, some of the stories which we're going to hear is we will know that it is never over even after it is over. And that is what is, you know, is the faith that we have to keep in mind as we go through these stories.
Might be jumping the gun here, but one of the resurrections we'll be speaking about is the resurrection of Walter Cowan. And that happened during the All India Conference of Satsai organizations, which was held at Madras, I think, in the year 1973. And that was a time, you know, when there was a lot of hostilities between India and Pakistan. It was very recently that the country of Bangladesh had got formed. Mm-hmm. And so there were a lot of political uncertainties, and many of the devotees at that time, you know, Hislop, Diana Baskin, the Cowans themselves, Walter Cowan and his wife Elsie Cowan, and a few others, all of them were in deep discussions with Swami, including Indulal Shah sir, all of them, in deep discussion with Swami as to whether this conference will go on, because, you know, there are so many restrictions and it's a wartime situation. And Swami said, no, everything will be fine, nothing will come in the way of the conference, because I have willed that it should be there. And just 2 or 3 weeks before that, all hostilities, everything ceased and everything came to a peaceful standstill, because of which this could go on. So, you know, when we say that nothing is impossible for Swami, literally nothing is impossible. It's not just at the level of individuals or a level of the village, at a country level, at a world level, at a cosmic level, at a universal level, at every level nothing is impossible. Nothing is impossible means nothing is impossible. Nothing is a big capital N nothing. And one such nothing is impossible gets demonstrated very early in Bhagwan's life itself, you know. I think it is in the year 1945, when Swami was still a teenager. That was the time when the first, possibly the first recorded resurrection happened. I say recorded because it's tough to keep track of the leelas of Bhagwan. Even now we are discovering more and more people coming and sharing leelas, so there is no way to say that these are the number of resurrections that Swami has done. But among the recorded resurrections, this is possibly the first, and this is also a very special resurrection, because I think this one Swami has narrated in great detail and depth on many occasions. So that is the resurrection of Karanam Subbamma in late 1945.
So I think, you know, every time we speak about this, we've spoken about this multiple times, the Satyam Shivam Sundaram, and I think even other times we've narrated it, but I don't think we can ever match Swami's narration of it, because who else can? I mean, probably the only other person who could come close to Swami's narration is the devotee who experienced that himself or herself. So here is Swami himself narrating that beautiful incident, you know, how Swami went to her, Swami had given her that promise. And I'm sure Swami explains all of that. We'll listen to that in Swami's own voice.
Just one part that is missing in this clip is, because Swami had started off the narration and then went into a detour before coming back.
Okay.
So Swami says that in order to visit one devotee, he had gone to Madras,
right,
what is today called Chennai, for 3 days. And the narration starts with him saying that after 3 days, I returned.
So actually, that returning is from Madras. Swami was going from Madras to Tirupati, and midway Swami comes.
Took a detour and started heading towards Puttaparthi. Right. Because even in those days, the way Swami narrates, and the way we have read it in the 1940s, a good motorable road was there only till Bukkapatnam.
Right.
From Bukkapatnam, you had to come by again bullock cart. And so Swami, on his way from Madras to Tirupati, takes a detour, heads towards Bukkapatnam, where Karanam Subbamma is. And yes, we will listen to Bhagwan narration. It's from a Shivratri discourse, 2005, I think the 9th of March,
2005.
Right.
Bhagwan stayed there for 3 days and returned. He returned in his car. Bhagwan got down there near Bukkapatnam and and was reaching Puttaparthi straight away from there.
కానీ ఆ రోడ్డు లోపల జనం చాలా చింతగా ఉంటున్నారు.
బట్ సమ్ పీపుల్ హూ ఆర్ నోటీస్డ్ ఆన్ ద వే సైడ్ హూ ఆర్ ఫీలింగ్ వెరీ సాడ్.
నేను అప్పుడు ఆ రోడ్ లోపలనే జట్కా బండిలో కూర్చొని వస్తున్నాను.
భగవాన్ వాజ్ ట్రావెలింగ్ బై జట్కా ప్రెసెంట్ ఇన్ దోస్ డేస్ అండ్ వాజ్ రీచింగ్ పుట్టపర్తి.
అప్పుడు కార్లు కూడా పుట్టపర్తికి వచ్చేటువంటివి కాదు.
ఇన్ దోస్ డేస్ ఈవెన్ కార్స్ డిడ్ హ్యావ్ యాక్సెస్ టు దిస్ ప్లేస్.
అప్పుడు బండిలో వస్తుంటే మాట్లాడుకుంటూ ఆ బండి తోడేటువంటి ఒక వ్యక్తి, స్వామి మీకు తెలియదా అన్నాడు.
భగవాన్ వాజ్ ఆన్ హిస్ వే టు పుట్టపర్తి, జట్కావాలా టోల్డ్ భగవాన్, డోంట్ యు నో దిస్?
ఏమిటి అని నేను ప్రశ్నించాను.
స్వామి ఆస్క్డ్ వాట్ ఇస్ ఇట్.
కానీ సుబ్బమ్మ ఇప్పుడు ఎక్కడున్నది అన్నాను.
అండ్ భగవాన్ ఆస్క్డ్ వేర్ ఇస్ సుబ్బమ్మ?
వారి తల్లిగారింట్లోనే వరండాలో పెట్టారు స్వామి డెడ్ బాడీని అన్నారు.
అండ్ ఆన్సర్ దట్ మ్యాన్ గేవ్ వాజ్ దిస్, ద బాడీ వాజ్ దేర్ రెస్టింగ్ అట్ ది రెసిడెన్స్ ఆఫ్ హర్ మదర్ ఇన్ ద వరండా.
నేను గట్టిగా నవ్వాను.
స్వామి లాఫ్డ్ లౌడ్లీ.
నేను ఆమెకి ఇచ్చిన మాటను నేను మరువలేదు, తాను మరువలేదు, కనుక తానింకా ప్రాణం పోలేదు అని నేను నాలో నేను తలుచుకుంటున్నాను.
Swami has not forgotten the promise given to her, and she too also is quite mindful of the promise received from Bhagavan. So it is clear that she has not died.
Neeriga aa bandini Subbamma intiki teesukoni poyaru.
And Swami went straight to the residence of Subbamma.
Kadapate varaku tamannu tarchukuntune vellindi Subbamma annaru.
They all said in one voice that Subbamma left her body thinking of Swami till the last moment.
ఎక్కడ పోయింది అన్నా నేను తెలియనట్టుగా.
Swami innocently has put this question, where has she gone?
అది ఎక్కడ పోయిందో మాకు తెలియదు, ఆమెలో ప్రాణం లేదు.
They said, where she has gone, we do not know, but she is not alive.
Doctors అందరూ చూచారు.
Doctors examined.
ఆనాడు బ్రాహ్మణ కనుక వాడు ఎవరిని దగ్గర చేర్చలేదు.
Brahmins in those days didn't allow anybody to come close to them.
Ullanta cheemala pattirai.
And the body is full of ants all around.
Kappinatvanti oka dippati teesi paravesaru.
And the blanket covering the body was removed.
Ullanta cheemaru.
And the body is full of ants all around.
Appudu nenu daggariki velli Subbamma Subbamma ani pilichanu.
Bhagavan went close to the body and said, Subbamma, Subbamma.
Kanulu terchindi.
She opened her eyes.
Swami eppudu vacharu ani prashninchindi.
She asked Swami, when did you come?
Ippude vacharu Subbamma anna.
And Bhagavan said, Subbamma, I have come just
now. Ana kanulu terchi Swami vaipu chustu maatladutu undetappudiki tana sodarulu tana sisters tana talli gabagaba intu lopala duraru.
As she was conversing with Swami, in the meantime, all her brothers and sisters came closer.
Endukatte Swamiki vantalu cheyalani.
Because they were all there to make preparations for Swami.
Naaku vantalato pani ledamma.
Swami said, I am not bothered about it.
Subbamma chuttaniki vachanu.
I have come here to see Subbamma.
Aamenu chuchanu.
I have seen her.
Nenu ikka neriga Puttaparthiki povachu.
And I can go straight to Puttaparthi now.
Telichi చేయి పట్టుకొని సుబ్బమ్మ ఏం తలుచుకుంటున్నావు అని ప్రశ్నించాను.
స్వామి కాట్ హోల్డ్ ఆఫ్ హ్యాండ్ అండ్ సెడ్ సుబ్బమ్మ వాట్ ఈస్ ఇట్ యువర్ థింకింగ్ అబౌట్?
సాయిరామ్ 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 అనుకుంటున్నాను స్వామి అనింది.
అండ్ సుబ్బమ్మ రిప్లైడ్, స్వామి ఐఎమ్ ఓన్లీ సేయింగ్ సాయిరామ్ సాయిరామ్ సాయిరామ్.
నా దగ్గర ఉన్నటువంటి ఒక కర్చీఫ్ తీసి ఆమె కంటి దారాలు తుడిచారు.
అండ్ స్వామి విత్ హిస్ కర్చీఫ్ వైప్డ్ అవుట్ హర్ టియర్స్.
తుడిచినప్పటికీ ఆమె ఇంకను నవ్వుతూ వచ్చేసింది.
అండ్ షీ వాజ్ స్మైలింగ్.
స్వామి ఇప్పటికైనా తాము చెప్పినటువంటి మాట జ్ఞప్తి అందుంది కదా అంది.
భగవాన్ యు స్టిల్ రిమెంబర్ ద ప్రామిస్ యు మేడ్ టు మీ?
అప్పుడు వారి తల్లి తమ్ముళ్ళు అందరూ కూడా వచ్చేశారు. డాక్టర్స్ అందరు కూడా వచ్చేశారు.
ఇన్ ద మీన్ టైమ్ ద బ్రదర్స్ సిస్టర్స్ మదర్ డాక్టర్స్ ఆల్ హావ్ అసెంబ్ల్డ్ దేర్.
వచ్చి ఇంతసేపు ఆ సుబ్బమ్మ పలకలేదే, రాత్రి నుండి కూడాను శ్వాసనే లేదే, ఏమిటిది విచిత్రము, ఇది సాయిబాబా శక్తియేమో అనుకున్నారు.
They were all very much surprised because she was not having any life, no breathing since last night. She was not talking to anybody. How is that she is talking now? Maybe the power of Bhagavan Baba.
Aame chei teesi na chei pattukundi.
And then she caught hold of Swami's hand.
Swami, entati marpu ledu meeku. Ee erukanta kudanu meeku ekkada nunchi vachindi.
Swami, you never forget. How is that you have got that remembrance?
చెప్పిన మాట తప్పేటువంటి వాడు కాదు సత్యసాయి.
సత్యసాయి విల్ నెవర్ బ్రేక్ ద ప్రామిస్ గివెన్.
తన పేరే సత్యం.
హిస్ నేమ్ వెరీలీ ఇస్ సత్య.
చెప్పినంతా కూడా సత్యమే కాని అసత్యంగా మారదు.
వాట్ ఎవర్ దట్ ఈస్ డిక్లేర్డ్ ఇస్ ట్రూత్, నథింగ్ బట్ ట్రూత్.
చెయ్యి తీసుకుంది, తన నొసట వ్రాత వేసుకుంది.
అండ్ షీ కెప్ట్ ద పామ్ ఆఫ్ భగవాన్ ఆన్ హర్ ఫోర్హెడ్.
నేను అప్పుడు విభూతి తీశాను, ఆమెకు నొసట వ్రాసాను.
Bhagavan materialized vibhuti for her and smeared it on her forehead.
Inka Subbamma, nuvu cheyamanga kannu musko.
And Bhagavan said, Subbamma, you can be so peaceful.
Neekittavarku ye chinta undinado aa chinta ippudu teerindi.
All that you have been worrying and thinking about, that promise, it is fulfilled.
Swami lede anetvanti chinta neeku ekku baadha pettu undiradi.
Inaadu
swami ni chuchavu, swami maatalu vinnavu, swami cheyi pattavu.
You are very much worried that you have to leave at a time when Swami is not here, that you could not talk to him, that you could not have a sip of water as promise given earlier. Now you could have all of them. Then Bhagavan said, Subbamma, I will now go to Puttaparthi.
Manchidi Swami, manchidi.
He said, yes Swami, yes.
Nannu kuda ekkada pampalo akkada pampinchesi meeru Puttaparthi cherandi anindi.
She said, Bhagavan, send me to that place where I have got to be sent and then you leave this place.
Naaka maata cheppindi kannu moosukundi.
So saying, she closed her eyes.
So that was the narration of that beautiful incident by Swami himself, the resurrection of one of the earliest devotees of Swami, Karnam Subbamma. In fact, we've spoken extensively about her during our Satyam Shivam Sundaram episodes, how she was, there are no words to describe, right, her devotion, the way she mothered Swami, the way she was probably the solitary support that Swami had, you know, in Puttaparthi in those days. The only person who literally held on to her devotion, and she had to really weather a lot. In fact, Swami tells elsewhere that that was a moment when everybody was mocking at her. That saying that, you know, you did so much for this boy and you went against your restrictions of caste and restrictions of your own, you know, she was supposed to be the richest one in the village and Swami's family was not so well off. And all of that, and you did so much, and we know that she gave the land which was where the Pathamandir came. And they said, all this you did and see where he is. He is not even there next to you when you need him the most. And I think elsewhere Swami also describes that even then, even though she's surrounded by all her relatives, she's constantly only calling out to Swami, even in delirium. And that irritates them more. So you can see that situation where, you know, literally everybody is mocking at her for making the choice of choosing Swami. And, you know, when this happens, you can imagine what a grand moment it was, right?
As Swami himself explained in the discourse, the reason here as to why he resurrected Subbamma seems to be that he had to fulfill the word that is given. But again, you know, if we look at it at a deeper level, we understand that this is an expression of love. This is just an expression of love from Bhagavan. And as we stated right in the beginning of the satsang, that this love is not the kind of love that we understand in everyday parlance. For us, love means doing something to make a person happy. And possibly happiness in a short term, or possibly in a long run. But the way we measure happiness is mostly the physical and mental happiness of a person. But divine love, the true love, pure love, is love that looks towards only the progress of the soul, whether the soul is progressing from Dehabhimana to Atmabhimana. And therefore, sometimes divine love will be appearing to be very cruel. It will look as if the body and the mind are being hammered out of shape. But that is what it is, because true love, divine love, pure love never sacrifices the soul for the body or the mind. It always sacrifices the body and mind at the altar of the soul. So that is how it is. And in this case also, if we see, this is an expression of love of Bhagwan, and whether we understand it or not, it is definitely an act of grace that was done, because it is going to help Subhama to move closer towards that Amritam that we spoke about. Away from Anritam, Anritam which is untruth, towards Amritam, Amritam which is immortality. And here Anritam or untruth is the association of oneself to one's body, while Amritam is association to the Atma, as we said. And here we can see that Karanam Subhama also was very ready for that, because as you said, even though all her relatives are around, she is not thinking of them, because when you are steeped in that kind of divine consciousness, what is family, who is friend, who is relative, nothing. All of that falls away. There is a kind of peaceful detachment. I would like to emphasize on peaceful detachment, because many times when we think we are detached, it is a very agitated detachment. It is a detachment that is coming, possibly being enforced on us, or possibly we are having it because we are not able to do anything. But this is when everything is in your control and yet you are detached and you are peaceful. So here, if she wants, she can respond, but she is not responding to any of her relatives. She is already in a state of preparedness, possibly to move from Dehabhimana to Atmabhimana. And this is what I felt is a very strong message from this episode, that it is not about Karanam Subhama being a supreme devotee. Of course she was a supreme devotee, but it is the reason that her soul, she needed this episode for the progress of her soul, and that is why Swami did it.
And what Swami says, a very important point that Swami emphasizes, is that, you know, once Swami gives a word, it will be kept. I think that is again a very, very beautiful point, because every time I listen to this episode, a statement which comes to my mind is what we would often quote even when we were students, that life with Swami is endless hope. Because when you talk of hope, you know, you talk of holding on to hope till the last moment. But this is a beautiful incident which says that when it comes to Swami, there is no last moment for that hope. There is no end for that hope. There is no moment beyond which the hope does not have validity.
A hopeless end becomes an endless hope.
Right. And here it's an endless hope because, you know, even if in the worldly term it has brought the end, I think that hope that Swami will fulfill what he has promised is there even after that. Literally, that's what Swami does. He comes and he says, no, this cannot be the end because I have not fulfilled my promise still, and he fulfills his promise. I think that is, again, as we said, these are episodes which should help us look at Swami in this way. I think that is what is important, because that is what will help us in our relationship with Swami too.
Absolutely. In the end, every word of Bhagwan is fulfilled. If it appears that it is not fulfilled, then it is not the end. I think that is what we should keep firm in our hearts. And that is the resurrection of Karanam Subhama. And before we go to the next resurrection, we will take a quick break at this point. We listen to this and think of our Bhagwan, get lost in his love, and then return back to the satsang to go on ahead with the next resurrection episode.
Mrityunjayaya namo.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We were talking about these beautiful experiences of grace where Swami extended people's lives. In fact, we are not talking, I mean, if we were to talk only about cases where Swami extended Swami's life, I think the list even of recorded events goes much, much longer than this. We are actually talking about incidents where Swami literally brought back people from the dead. But before we narrate more incidents, I think there is another incident which probably will slip in here, which is not really Swami bringing back somebody after they are dead. But it gives us a perspective of why Swami showers this grace on some people. Because that is something which we started off with. We said that's more important. Because the idea of Swami giving rebirth is not common. But the idea of what Swami wants us to learn during life is common for everybody. I think so that is what we need to concentrate on. And the person whose life we'd like to narrate is that of Seshagiri Rao. Again, a person who featured extensively during a Satyam Shivam Sundaram episodes, because he was the person who came to Swami very, very early in 1945. He was the first pujari of the old mandir. And we know that beautiful experience he had of seeing Swami as Shiva, and that's how he stays back.
And I think his family has been having a long association across generations with Bhagwan.
Right. Dr. Padmanabhan from Bangalore, and Gita Mohan Ram, whose talks we play very often on the radio, all of these come from his family. And he was himself a very, very spiritually evolved person, because we spoke of how he gives up everything and stays back with Swami, and that does not come easily. And, Professor Kasturi narrates this incident. I think he writes about it in Satyam Shivam Sundaram Part 2, where this is a man, he's been serving Swami for 14 years. So this must be, I think, maybe 58, 57, 58, at least after the General Hospital was inaugurated, because he's admitted in General Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is he has a fall, and we know that at that age, usually a fall becomes very fatal. And that's what happens to him after that fall. His health deteriorates, he becomes very sick, and comes to a point where the doctors have given up. They say that it's probably his last few days. And the beautiful thing is, this man is lying in his deathbed, and Professor Kasturi writes that he starts chanting incantations of the Isha Upanishad, which speak of, I am not this body, I am going to be released, and I am freer, I am not bound by the body. And everybody around is so thrilled by the sight. Here is a great devotee, a person who's been worshipping Lord Shiva for so many years, who's had the darshan of Lord Shiva, who's had the opportunity to serve Lord Shiva. And in the last moments, he's chanting these such appropriate mantras from Vedanta.
Hmm.
So they're like looking at him with envy, this is how we all would like to die. But what happens is when he's doing this, somebody goes and informs Swami that looks like Seshagiri Rao is in his last few moments. And Swami comes, and Swami shouts at Seshagiri Rao and says, how dare you try to leave without my permission?
Mm-hmm.
Get up and continue your duty. Come, I'm waiting for you. Come, attend bhajans and give aarti. And Swami walks off and Professor Kasturi writes that we were all shocked by this unkindness of Swami. You know, here is this person, a perfect setting to, you know, slip into death for an ideal devotee, and Swami is literally snatching it away from him. So the story goes that after some time he actually becomes better, goes to the mandir, gives aarti to Swami, and I think for something like 6 months he is fine after that. He is absolutely fine continuing his duties as the pujari. Then again he falls sick after some time, and this was the time he is admitted in the general hospital, and this time he literally suffers. He is having a disease, and you know, he loses his, you know, he becomes very senile, loses control over his bowels and his bladder, and I mean, everybody is looking at him with such pity. He's suffering, his children come, they plead with Swami that they want to take him to Bangalore so that, you know, he can admit him in a hospital, bigger hospital, and his grandchildren and children will take care of him. Swami says, nothing doing, he'll be here only. And Swami explained that, see, if I wanted to give him death, I would have given it to him 6 months back. I've given him an extension so that he can work out this karma. So don't take him away. Swami said he'll be fine after some time. You leave him here. And that's how it happens. He goes on like this for, I think, almost a month. Suffers in the general hospital. Then after that he becomes completely fine again. Back to normal again. He gets discharged from the hospital. And Kasturi writes that for 6 weeks he is back to his duties, performing puja in the mandir. And then suddenly he falls sick. And this time he has fallen sick very quickly. He is bedridden. And Swami comes to him. Swami asks for hot milk. Swami feeds him that milk spoon by spoon. And then Swami says, yeah, now he can rest. And even as Swami is leaving the room, Swami stops, turns back and says, now you have my ticket. You can go. Swami says, go and come. You know, I mean, my blessings are there with you. And Swami walks out. And within few minutes, he actually passes away. I think it's a very beautiful incident. You know, when you talk of grace, I think it's a very important thing. Grace is not always just extension of life. Extension of life does not always mean good health. And good health does not necessarily equate to grace. Grace can come in any form.
It goes back to the point we discussed that Bhagwan does everything. Extension of life, resurrection, even gifting of death. Whatever he does out of love. And what is this love? Love is not about the comfort, pleasure and joy of the body and mind, but the pleasure, comfort and joy of the soul. And that is why, you know, from a very external point of view, if you look at it, Swami, you simply tortured a devotee. A great devotee got tortured. If you had just allowed him, he was chanting mantras from the Upanishad or whatever you said. He was chanting things that are keeping him mentally very calm, and physically he's in a comfortable situation. He has no problems. If he could just slip off away, it would have been a very peaceful death. But no, Swami, you cancelled that. And after that, for months, he had to undergo terrible, torturous life. I mean, it was a very painful life physically and mentally. You know, he became senile, his body became weak. But that's what it is. What Swami does need not necessarily be good for the body and mind. If it happens to be good for the body and mind, then fine. See, those are the things that we write about, we speak about and we celebrate. Whenever Swami does something that is good for the soul, not whenever, always he does that only, which is good for the soul, but it happens to be bad for the body and mind, we just conveniently neglect it, avoid it, and the critics pick on these and say, how can God be so cruel? How can this be a God? How can this person be? This is what the critics do and this is what the devotees do. Devotees, you know, conveniently say, leave it off, we can't explain it. But the explanation is actually very simple. Though we might not be able to get a logical proof for each and every situation, the explanation is that whatever the Lord is doing, He is doing it for the uplift of the soul. If it happens to be comfortable and convenient for the body and mind, so be it. If it happens to be inconvenient for the body and mind, so be it. That is not at all in the priority. He doesn't, you know, even possibly give a thought for that. So therefore, I think this is a very beautiful example which shows that it is not as if an improvement in the physical and mental condition takes place when grace flows. An improvement in the physical and mental condition is only a side effect. It's like when I take a medicine, the side effect might be sleep, which I love. I can sleep now. Or the side effect might be a rash on my skin, which is irritating me. But the doctor will not be thinking only of the side effect. Of course, there are some situations where doctor specifically thinks of some side effects. But in a general case, the doctor is always thinking about taking care of the problem, not of the side effect. So too in the general case, except some specific examples or exceptions, God always takes care of the root treatment, the root cause, this thing, and not about the side effects.
Right. You know, every time you see some of these movies or stories where you have a person who is excelling in a sport or in the martial art, and you'll have this master, and they will always show these moments where the master is being very, very unkind and cruel to the, you know, to the student.
Disciple, yes.
And that's the time when actually the real training happens. And we see this all the time. And I think when we did the satsang on the true qualities of a real master, we had made this statement, and I think it's very, one of the persons very fond of this statement is Hari Shankar, whom I do the evening program with. He always says this, the master has ruthless compassion. Right? It's an oxymoron, but it's so perfect because his compassion is beyond what we think is kindness and you know, ruthlessness. And that is why it is compassion, but sometimes it is ruthless compassion, because it is a compassion shown to a much higher level of our existence than we can even relate to sometimes.
Immediately brings to my mind about how if there are two people watching the hatching of a butterfly from the pupal stage, and as it hatches, the butterfly struggles a lot. Its wings are very tender, delicate. It's enclosed. It's wrapped up like a ball in that egg. In the cocoon. And as it's breaking out. So now, there is one person who assists the butterfly to break out. He separates the cocoon with his fingers and makes it easier for that little creature to come out, while the other apparently coldly, heartlessly is just watching and apparently enjoying the struggle of the butterfly. So if you stop it at this point, it looks like here is a compassionate being and here is a ruthless being. But then when the butterflies come out, the one that struggled to break the cocoon is the one that will fly, because scientifically also, that struggle is very much essential for the butterfly to strengthen its wings. And a person who has knowledge of that is the one who is able to be ruthlessly compassionate, who is able to, you know, swallow the opinions of everyone around him who is thinking that he is ruthless, knowing in his heart that what I am doing is best for that being, and that is what will make the being actually happy. Because finally, the other butterfly which you have helped in hatching will definitely not fly. When I had visited the Bannerghatta National Park in Bangalore, they have one separate dome which is meant for breeding butterfly species.
Oh, okay.
And depending on the time of the year you go, you see the numbers differently, you know. Sometimes you'll have hundreds of butterflies, sometimes you'll have a few dozen of them. So it all depends on the time. But when we had gone there, there was this person who was explaining how there was a butterfly, and on one plant there was the different stages also of the butterfly, you know. So one was almost hatching and coming out, and he also made it a point to tell that, see, it is looking like it's struggling, but if you help it now, it will immediately die after coming out. Don't help it, just watch on. Means, a person with knowledge will know that love is about not helping and allowing it to struggle. So if that is true with people with little extra knowledge, then what to speak of the ocean of knowledge, the Jnana Sagara. When he is the ocean of knowledge, definitely whatever he is doing is out of supreme compassion and love, and therefore I think Brother Hari Shankar is perfect in terming it as ruthless compassion in the worldly terms.
Right, and I think that is why I thought we should narrate this incident, because though it is not resurrection per se, in fact if we probably have the time after we have done with the resurrection stories, there are so many stories like this where Swami has given an extension of life for a certain purpose. In fact, maybe we'll not have the time to speak about Walter Cohen today. Even his life extension was a certain for us, certain purpose, and that we will leave it for later. But I think chronologically speaking, another very important family which was given this grace was a family which came again in the 1940s, just like how Seshagiri Rao and his family were one of the pioneers in the old Mandir days. Another family which was very, very close to Swami, which remained very close to Swami for a long time, is the Kuppam family. And even they were given this act of grace.
In fact, it is said that they were the first among the devotees to begin addressing Swami as Swami.
Swami, right.
Till then he was Balasai and young Baba or Satyam and all that. So this is the resurrection of Mr. Radha Krishnan. We have the Kuppam Vijayamma, who has written the book Anyatha Sharanam Nasti.
Right.
So this is the father of Kuppam Vijayamma, so Kuppam Radhakrishnan. But I think before we go into that story, we'll take another quick little break. On the other side of the break, dear listeners, don't go away anywhere, because there's another beautiful and thrilling episode of resurrection of Kuppam Radhakrishna by our beloved Bhagwan that's coming up. Welcome back, dear listeners. We will go into the episode of the resurrection of Kuppam Radhakrishnan. It was in the year 1953 during the Dasara festival that this happened, and it happened in a very interesting manner. The Kuppam family, that is Radhakrishna and his wife Radhamma, along with their daughter Vijaya, who later we call as Vijayamma, the famous Kuppam Vijayamma of the Anyatha Sharanam Nasti fame. So Vijaya and her husband Hemchand. So these were the four people who had come to the Prashantinilayam, but not for Dasara. They came because Radhakrishna was suffering from severe bouts of stomach ache due to gastric ulcers. And the pain became so severe, none of the medication seemed to help. It just happened to be Dasara time as far as he was concerned. He wanted to rush to Swami to seek relief from this. And so during the Dasara of 1953, the four of them landed in Prashantinilayam. Prashantinilayam must have been the old Prashantinilayam Mandir, not the one that we see today, because
right.
I think this came much later, 1970s, and that time it was the Mandir that was fashioned according to the Shivaji Theatre in Bangalore. So, but even then, you know, when we look at the photos, we realize that it is having the same kind of structures, like the interview room position is the same, right. Swami's room position is the same. The position remains same, only the external shape is different. So they had come, and it was after 2 days of staying in Prashantinilayam that Radhakrishna was unable to bear it any longer, and he went to Swami, fell at his feet, and he said, Swami, give me moksha, give me mukti, let me merge at your feet, because I am not able to bear this pain any longer. And Swami just smiled and said, no, don't worry, the pain will subside, hold on, you know. And after he said that, he also ensured that Radhakrishna stays in the room attached to the mandir itself. So I don't know exactly where, I am assuming possibly it is in the room that was bang opposite to the interview room.
Right.
Because there was an additional guest room, like which later years got converted to a storeroom. So Swami told, let him stay in the mandir itself, and that is where Radhakrishna was staying. By the way, Radhakrishna was a factory owner and a very well-known person in Kuppam.
Right.
In Chittur district of Andhra Pradesh. So he was there, he was staying, and each hour as it passed by, his situation seemed to get worse and worse. The third day of their arrival, that is one day after he had asked Swami for this moksha, he got a very swollen tummy, and he got into a fit, you know, a kind of fit, because of which he bit his own tongue, his tongue began to bleed, and he collapsed, and he was like unconscious. Immediately the wife and daughter rushed to Swami, and Swami came there, he materialized vibhuti, put it on his forehead, assured them, said, don't worry, it'll all be fine. And because Swami is there assuring you, he has done all this, they also felt happy, they felt relieved. But his situation didn't seem to improve. The whole day his situation just deteriorated further and further. So much so, on the next day, that is the fourth day of their arrival in Prashantinilayam, he had very limited consciousness. He was not able to pass urine. His stomach became bloated even more. So the son-in-law, that is Hemchand, he rushed to a nearby town and got a nurse, a male nurse, in order to take care of Radhakrishna, his father-in-law. And this male nurse came and he felt for the pulse, and he said that, you know, I don't think there can be much done about him, because it's just a matter of time before he dies, if he is not already dead. That is how he said, because he could hardly feel a pulse. And we must remember that this is the year 1953. Even the first general hospital in Puttaparthi came only in 1954. I mean, the foundation was laid for it in 1954. Recently we had their 62nd anniversary celebrations. So 56, I think, was the inauguration.
Right.
54 was the foundation stone put. So there was no modern medical facilities in Puttaparthi. So I don't know if he had a meter or machine to see the pulse, but he said that there is no pulse. When this happened, again the mother and daughter rushed to Swami, and they said, Swami, you know, people, the person who is supposed to be trained medically, he says that my husband is dead. And again Swami laughs and he says, you don't listen to what people are saying.
By the time they go, he actually starts turning cold. You mean absolutely motionless and he starts becoming cold. That's when they run again to him.
Because these are the external factors, you know.
Right.
He turns, he even turns dark. The skin becomes dark, which are all the signs of death and decay setting in. The skin started losing its luster. All these things happen. And that is why they rush to Swami. But Swami seems to be laughing it off. He laughs it off and he says, don't pay attention to what people are saying. But possibly to Asuaj, these two, the mother and daughter and also the son-in-law, later in the day, Swami comes and sees the patient, but he just stands looking at this being prostrate on the floor there, lying down. He just sees him and Swami says, yeah, it's fine, don't worry, and just walks away. Now the mother on one hand, not the mother, I mean, yeah, his wife actually, that is Radhamma. Radhamma and Vijayamma, both of them, on one hand, they are so worried about their father, but on the other hand, they're confident that no, nothing can happen because Swami has said nothing will happen. That is the kind of faith Radhamma has. In fact, I read an article in which they're comparing Radhamma to the Savitri of our epics, because Savitri is said to have fought off the god of death, Yama, from coming and taking Satyavan, her husband. And here Radhamma sat like that because everyone around came and started telling her that your husband is dead, you know, you have to start making arrangements for the funeral. In fact, some of the devotees went forward and asked Swami whether we should send the family back to Kuppam where they can do the funeral, or should we do the funeral rites in Puttaparthi. And Swami just brushed them away saying nothing needs to be done. It was at this point in time that the Raja of Venkatagiri, who was also a devout follower of Bhagwan, and he was a person who definitely had a lot of resources at his beck and call. He came and he tried to tell this family that if you need, let me offer you my services to take him to the nearest hospital. Okay, because others are saying that he's dead, but you're not ready to accept it. Let's take him to the hospital. Let's get him a proper treatment there. But the modern day Savitri that she was, Radhamma just sat there and said, nothing, this person, my husband, is not going to move from here till Swami says. And with that she held on. The day 6, that is the day 3, after he has become unconscious and he has become motionless, you know, the smell starts emanating and even outside the room people are able to smell it. And really, you know, devotees in their hearts possibly were praying that Swami, for the sake of some kind of sanctity and sanity of the place, we should be doing the burial and cremation. And Swami tells that I will come and see Radha Krishna today. And every devotee, most of the devotees must have thought, what will you see him? I mean, you're going to see a dead body there. You're going to see a corpse. Swami had said he would come. So the Vijayamma and Radhamma both are waiting. They're waiting for Swami to come. 10 minutes pass, hours pass, and Swami is not coming only. Finally, when Swami arrives, you know, they just go rush to Swami and break down, because I think this is the pressure buildup of the last 3 days that they're venting out. Till now, everybody is coming and they had to hold on as reservoirs of strength, but this is the first time where the reservoir of strength, the reservoir of all the strength in the universe is before them, and they freely break down and cry. And Swami tells them to be calm. He tells them to stay out and he walks into the room alone, shuts the door. 5 minutes or 10 minutes later, Swami opens the door, and to their pleasant shock, to their wonderment, to their amazement, they see Radha Krishnan sitting there on a sofa, comfortably there. His skin is back, his skin tone is back, his skin is full of life again, it's bubbling, there is no darkness. Everything is gone, there's no smell, nothing, and it's mind-boggling, and they continue to cry. They continue to cry because they just aren't unable to comprehend what is happening. And Swami, you know, is so jokingly tells his husband, look, here, calm your wife and daughter, they're crying so much. And Radha Krishna also, he says, no, why are you crying? What happened? You know, he's oblivious of what they have gone through for the last 3 days. And Swami then tells the wife, Radhamma, that, hey, you know, he's hungry. He needs some warm beverage. So get something for him. So she makes Horlicks. That's what the daughter has said. She makes Horlicks and gets it. And first few spoons, Swami only feeds to Radha Krishna, after which the wife feeds the husband, and he walks out as though nothing has happened. And definitely it becomes, slowly as the news spreads, it becomes the talk of the mandir. And later on, you know, when Swami was speaking to Kasturi Garu, he tells Kasturi Garu that, see, Radha Krishna had not prepared his will or anything like that. So it was not yet the time. So therefore I thought I'll give him an extension. Whatever extension I have given it to him, don't worry, I will be deducting it from his next birth. As if like settling the accounts. That's how Swami tells Kasturi. In fact, when Swami opens the door and when Radha Krishna asks Swami, why are they crying? When he asks that, Swami says, no, just because they're crying because I did a delivery. That is when Radhamma and the daughter noticed that his stomach is no longer bloated. He didn't have even the slightest gastric trouble after that. But you know, when you look at the choice of Swami's words, it's so amazing and thrilling. Swami says delivery because it is He who delivers us from Mrityu to Amritam. And that is what Swami is mentioning again there in a very cryptic manner, but a beautiful poetic manner, the kind of poet that he is. He said that I have done his deliverance.
Whenever we listen to stories like this, it's very, very stunning and so dramatic in listening to it. But I think we just cannot even understand what it is to be in that situation of that wife or that daughter. Mm. And imagine this is 1950s, and we know the kind of hostility which was there, you know, when you say that they come and tell the wife that, you know, why are you wasting your time, take the body. It's smelling, you know, that's like, how do you, I mean, imagine the amount of, I mean, people, what they would have spoken to her, you know, it's not just devotees. So, though it was in Swami's mandir, not everybody there were Swami's devotees. There were still people looking at Swami as, you know, imagine here is this 20-odd-year-old young man who is 8th standard pass out from the village. That's how most of them look at him. Mm. And here is somebody who needs real advanced medical care. And he walks in and he says, no, he'll be fine, don't worry, he'll go away. I mean, the amount of pressure that would have been on the family to do something about the, you know, husband who's sinking, be it the treatment or the funeral later, would have been immense. You can't even imagine what it would have been in that situation. And that moment later when they walked into the room, and as you said, the man was as fresh or in fact even better than what he was when he came to Prashanthi Nilayam. And you know, there are no words to describe how they would have felt at that moment. And what faith it would have given them and the people around who would have witnessed the whole thing.
You know, speaking of this only, Prem, you know, when you say people around who are witnessing, this is one thing that fascinates me and definitely makes me conclude, you know, that this has to be divine. See, just imagine yourself or myself in Swami's position. If you or me had the power and I have come on a mission which involves the entire world and the entire universe, wouldn't I utilize a situation like this for the best marketable manner? I mean, I know that after 3 days I'm going to resurrect him and everyone knows that he's dead. Why should I go shut my door and do it? Why can't I bring him out in the courtyard? I mean, I was thinking that this is what I would have done if I was Swami, you know. Bring him out in the courtyard and tell everybody, you fellows, you don't have faith. No, just come here. No, just come. All of you come. Because there are so many, as you said, there are so many critics and skeptics swarming around the place. And in plain sight, just do it. Okay. But that Swami doesn't seem to care at all. Because as Swami says, my miracles are not for pradarshana, they are for nidarshana. They are not for exhibitionism. This is not a magic show. That's why, you know, if we look at many of Swami's miracles, he doesn't seem to be good at marketing it, or, you know, the visual impact is very, very low, because Swami does it of like natural, like how you and me are breathing it. That's how he does of the miracle. Even when he would materialize vibhuti or a golden ring, you know, in the audience. Just imagine when a magician pulls out a ring from somewhere and you know that it is not a creation that's happening there. He's just pulling it out of somewhere. But it's his ingenuity that you're not able to make out how it is and you feel that it's a creation. For that, there's a thunderous applause. And how many times it has happened, Prem, that Swami has materialized a necklace or a chain or a ring or vibhuti or many things and you and me have not applauded. It has become so commonplace or natural for us because it is natural for Swami. the way Swami did it. And I feel that is an attribute that only the divine has. Because any human will try to gain maximum mileage out of everything that we have. Not only about any ability that we have, we try to gain maximum mileage out of it. I think it's only the divine that has no need to do that, because all the abilities are His.
And the thing with, you know, all the these kind of miracles which Swami performs is, I mean, even as I said that all the people around would have had their faith reinforced. The truth is, if they had faith, it would have been reinforced. If they did not have the faith, there was no, I don't think there would be a blossoming of faith. At the same time, if you were a doubter, I think Swami had given enough options that they can go away by saying that no, something would have happened. No, that smell was because of something else.
And
or actually he was not dead.
How I'm saying that it is an attribute of the divine, because of which he didn't come and make an exhibition, but just shut the door and did it off. The same thing I feel a critic will say, why did he have to do behind closed doors? Because there is something fishy there. I mean, I don't think anything was fishy there other than the smell that was emanating there,
and of course
which was gone.
And they will say that why wasn't a doctor called to declare the patient dead, or what happened after that? Of course, the incidents which we're going to be narrating next week will negate all of these arguments, because most of them happened under the care of doctors in hospitals, and we will come to that eventually. But, you know, that is what it is. If you have faith, it gets reinforced. If you have doubt,
It gets reinforced.
Right.
As with any action with Bhagwan. You know, another interesting point that struck me as I read this is also the way Radha Krishna prays to Bhagwan. When he goes and tells, give me merger at your lotus feet because I'm unable to bear this pain. Swami says, no, I will ease the pain. This is my reading, my understanding. It's almost like Swami saying that, don't say you want to merge in my lotus feet because you're having pain. If you are having pain, I will give you freedom from the pain. It is only when you want to merge in my lotus feet, because you want to merge in my lotus feet, that is when it becomes a true achievement. It gains true meaning for us. Because when we realize that the thing that we seek the most in our life, the thing without which life is meaningless, is His lotus feet, and therefore we want the lotus feet. When we want His lotus feet for the sake of the lotus feet, that is true blessing. Otherwise it doesn't remain a blessing. It will be like how often, you know, the example is given of the fly that is hovering there and sits on Swami's feet. We have seen it many times. There would be flies and they would sit, and Swami has got such mastery over His body and senses. I have never seen Him like, you know, imagine a fly sits on your nose. How we violently jerk and, you know, because we get tickled and irritated. I have never seen Swami do that. Even when a honeybee flew near His face. So that is Swami's absolute mastery over His body and mind. But when a fly sits on the lotus feet, you don't envy the fly. Or possibly you momentarily envy it, because you'll see the next moment it goes, sits on a pigeon dropping there. I mean, so it's not about, you know, it's not about anything that touches the feet is liberated. A lot of what is your attitude towards the feet matters in getting you liberation by touching the feet. So also, if you want to merge in the lotus feet, because your wife is troubling you, or because a disease is troubling you, or because your father is upset with you, these kind of reasons, then no. Swami doesn't want us to miss the opportunity of getting the grand merger because of all these distractions. Because if He says, if these are the reasons why you want, I'll remove these reasons. Finally, you should come to say that I want to merge in the lotus feet because I want to merge in the lotus feet. That is when you'll get all the benefit.
And absolutely. In fact, we've spoken about this. The vairagya or the detachment which comes can be caused by different things. And broadly categorized, they say, you know, vairagya can come from virakti, which is disgust. And we see that disgust and a kind of dispassion comes when you see something which is very hurtful, very painful, or when something becomes too much. You know, even then you get virakti leading to vairagya will always be ephemeral. You know, it will come and go. But Swami says that vairagya should come because you found something greater. Swami would say that tripti should be the cause of vairagya. That what I want will not be found in this, so I am not interested in this. I have found something greater. Now, that's what Mother Meera sings in that bhajan. He says, I have found a wealth which is far more greater than anything I can find, so I have given up everything in the world. I have lost everything in the world because I found something which is greater than everything else.
It should not be that I have kept trying to earn money. I have flopped it miserably. Therefore, I am detached from money.
Right. That should never be the thing. As you said, you know, that's a beautiful observation. You cannot seek Swami because you have not been able to find anything else, or you've got pain seeking something else, so I might as well seek Swami. And if you seek it that way, I think even then Swami will be compassionate and say, fine, at least this way you're coming to me. But you will not be able to secure Swami in that process. If you want to finally hold on to Swami and have Swami infinitely, because that is what is Amrutattvam when you talk of immortality, that will not come unless you come for the God's sake, not for Swami's sake.
And on the same note, another point that struck is the Venkatagiri Raja coming and offering. Possibly he can be taken as a metaphor for worldly strengths and influences that we have. You know, it often happens that we turn to Swami or God as the last resort because we feel, you know, this problem I can manage. This I can manage. Only when it goes to this situation, then I can't manage. It is wrong to think, it is illusory to think that this I can manage, because as they say, without his will, even a blade of grass doesn't move. So, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't put our efforts, but let us know that I'm putting my effort because it's my duty, but everything is him. It is amazing how Radhamma refuses. Because I'm thinking, possibly if I was in her, every time when I go through this experience, I put myself in that place just to imagine how my thought process would be, that's all. I'm thinking that if I was in Radhamma's place, I would have definitely grabbed this offer of Venkat Giri Raja with both hands. Imagine my mother or father is dying and or, you know, I'm doubtful. I don't know whether they're dead or alive. It is there. And somebody comes and says, you know what, instantly I will get you. I will get you a chartered flight. We'll fly them to the best hospital in America and let's... I don't know. Means, should I take this as Swami coming through to me through them? Or should I say, no need. When Swami is there, I don't want you. I mean, I think this can be just debated on and on. It totally depends on our level of evolution, our understanding of Swami, but it is definitely a point to ponder about, because when I'm in such a situation, often things would be put like that. I'm in dire need of money, I don't have money, I'm walking in the park, I find an empty purse there. I find a purse there without any identification, which has 2000 rupees in it. Do I take this as an answer to my prayer, or do I take this as a test? I mean, this is something to ponder about possibly, and it will be nice to conclude our satsang on a point to ponder about, because that is what happened here. You know, I was pondering as to, did Radhamma do the right thing? Because Venkat Giri Raja is a devotee of Swami, and it will be very easy to think that possibly this is the way Swami is planning to help. So that is something left for our listeners to decide and for each one of us to ponder about. But with that, dear listeners, I think we'll bring this satsang to a close. We hope it has been enjoyable to you as it has been for us. We will be continuing the same theme the next week also, because as we said, we have a few more amazing resurrection stories with beautiful lessons and points that we can ponder about. That will have to wait for next week. Right now we will be ending with a song, on the other side of which will be the segment Love to Love. We offer this at the lotus feet of our beloved Bhagwan, and we pray to him that we should seek his lotus feet always for the sake of his lotus feet. Thank you. Jai Sairam.
Karuna Bharana Karma Bharana. ధరించితివి. ఉద్ధరింపగలేవు అవతరించితివి, ప్రేమామృతం పంచి మరలమమ్ము.
అమృతస్య పుత్రులుగా చేయుమా స్వామి, అమృతస్య పుత్రులుగా చేయుమా స్వామి.
మెసలేటప్పుడు చదువు ధనము కాపాడవుగా, మృత్యువు దాపున మెసలేటప్పుడు చదువు ధనము కాపాడవుగా.
మార్కండేయుని మాదిరిగా రక్షిం
అంధకారము ఇహ బంధాలకు కారణము. అహమును దునిమి అమృతత్వముకు దారి చూపుమా రావణ మార్గన. కనుల ముందర నిండు కులువైన తండ్రికిరే వందనం, మా గుండెలలో తాండవమాడెను నిన్ను చూడగా ఆనందం.
కనుల ముందర నిండు కులువైన తండ్రికిరే వందనం, మా గుండెలలో